and in another 35 or 36 countries of the world because of these coercive economic measures. And this book, Sanctions, a Wrecking Ball in the Global Economy, is an account of these measures and their effect in various countries of the world. So it's a nice little book with many, many examples from all over the world of how sanctions have been used by the West to cripple and destroy the economies of countries in the global South for political gain.
Yeah, and it's always dressed up as, you know, humanitarian. As you mentioned, it's all for their own good, and it's a kinder, gentler hand. The speakers, I'm looking at the poster for the tour for the book, and you can correct my pronunciation if I get this wrong, but Halia Dutagi, John Philpott, who's been on this program before, and Judy Bello are the three speakers that are, it's just in the East, I see, Toronto, Hamilton, Ottawa, and Montreal, starting on April 18th, that's next Tuesday, right, in Toronto, and then moving to Hamilton, Ottawa, and Montreal. Ken, we're fast out of time for this segment. Perhaps we can come back to this in the second segment, but for the rest of you, I want you to stay tuned because I've got John Helmer coming up right after the break, and we're going to talk about what's going on in Canada. John is an expert in Russian, all matters Russian, but he's also looked into the situation in Canada here where the government and corporate interests have gotten together to demonize people like Ken and myself and to become trolls. And they're doing this through initially Twitter. But anyway, we'll get to that. It's complicated, but it's worth listening to. Thanks, Ken, for coming on for this segment. And we'll continue on.
Okay.
Word, sound, power. Guerrilla Radio, get your power.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, if the Ottawa Weather Vane, Globe and Mail is any indication, its chief political scribe Stephen Chase's recent article headed pro-Kremlin Twitter accounts weaponizing fringe users to erode Canadian support for Ukraine, study finds, signals a new Canadian understanding of citizenship with an unmistakable McCarthyite tinge. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. The principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, Helmer has, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and his latest is Australian Fascism, How It Destroyed the Courts. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks very much for having me. Chris, can I correct that reference, which is a very complimentary reference to the Globe and Mail as a weather vane? Now, weather vanes are useful things. They rotate and tell you which way the wind's blowing. No. The Globe and Mail is a white flag. It's a defeat flag onto which, unfortunately, some of their most untruthful correspondents, we won't mention their names, we don't want to embarrass they've planted on their white flag, a retreat flag, the maple leaf, and make it look, in order to make what the Globe and Mail is doing look Canadian and patriotic. It isn't. It's foolish, and it's deceptive. But anyway, weather vane or white flag, that's the Globe and Mail. We'll do a bit better here.
Well, we'll use it to see which way the wind blows. And as a Canadian, I can say that there's nothing better is a better emblem of Canada right now than a white flag. And the Globe and Mail, it does show a lot of Canadians, especially in the East, count on it. It's called the national paper, after all, although it's they themselves that call it that. But they don't get everything. And one of the things the Globe or the Mop and Pail has missed is your 2021 Hellevig Memorial lecture. They didn't cover it, and I don't think any other Canadian media, to my knowledge, has either, except right here we're going to do today. And that's a pity because most Canadians, John, have no idea how the media in this country works and are entirely unaware of the troll farms feeding the media frenzy and feeding them the narratives being sold as truth. Now, you write about these and you elucidate one foremost among them, the McDonald Laurier Institute. For those Canadians who aren't aware, maybe those who only read the Globe and Mail, who is the McDonald Laurier Institute?
The McDonald Laurier Institute, named after some well-known historical Canadian names, the MLI, is based in Ottawa. It takes roughly $3 million worth of Canadian money every year and to produce a series of reports and press releases, which have a particular political line. And we'll come to the sort of cybersecurity counter disinformation line in a minute. But it's $3 million sounds a lot, but when divided by all the so-called senior fellows the MLI says it hires, it produces a very paltry sum, a nominal sum. The chap we're going to be looking at, the most recent alleged Russian disinformation report author, Marcus Kolga, gets from MLI roughly a bit less than $30,000 Canadian dollars a year. Now, all of our listeners, certainly the guerrilla radio audience, understands how little distance Canadian dollars go these days. And MLI basically allegedly represents, as its senior fellows, people trying to make money from other places selling disinformation themselves, selling propaganda. So MLI represents a kind of platform, a tribune, the big end of a trumpet to take people paid elsewhere to do their job, and it gives them a few extra bucks to produce propaganda propping up the Canadian government's, or let's call it the Freeland government's, war against the Ukraine, the war, Trudeau's war against China. That, by the way, gets paid for by the Japanese. The war against China gets paid for by the Taiwanese. What we're going to be talking about is tracing the so-called disinformation warriors of the kind that McDonald Laurier says they are hiring back to the money, follow the money into the back pocket of the information warriors. And that's where you see the stuff is coming from. So it's a mouthpiece.
So Stephen Chase over at the Mop and Pail there, in his article, it's on the surface at least, it's a study of the report Enemy of My Enemy that was released through the University of Regina's Center for Artificial Intelligence Data and Conflict, that in coordination with the University of Maryland College of Information Studies. And someone else, a not-for-profit called the Digital Public Square, and they working out of Toronto, funded by governments on both sides of the borders, or at least in part. And the mastermind, the man of the hour, the man that you're talking about hired through this, is one Marcus Kolga, the founder in Canada of an outfit called Disinformation Watch, one of these myriad mushroom-like outfits popping up to assure the veracity of what is being transpiring on the web. Who is this Marcus Kolga guy? I hadn't really heard of him until reading your piece.
Well, it's not the first time I've looked at Mr. Kolga, but for everybody to understand, Marcus Kolga has a Nazi grandfather problem, just like Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland. When you look into both of them, and it kind of started here for Freeland, Freeland's grandfather was Mikhail Chomiak from Lvov, Ukraine. During World War II, he was a paid spy and a propagandist for the German army and the German occupation authority in Poland and the Ukraine during World War II. Now, that didn't come from me. That started with with the Polish police files, the U.S. Army files, Canadian and Ukrainian records, including one of Ms. Freeland's relatives, who's a very distinguished retired historian of the Ukraine in a Western Canadian university. Now, Papa Chomiak, a grandfather to Freeland, stole an apartment, a printing press, antiques, and a car from Jews whose murder in a nearby concentration camp Chomiak used to promote in his publications. He also supported the liquidations of Russians and Poles. Well, Mr. Freeland goes on to represent much of the ideology of her grandfather and certainly the liquidation of Russians. Now, Kolga's grandfather comes from Estonia. That was Eduard Kolga. Now, he was a volunteer. This is all in Eduard Kolga's memoirs as published by Marcus Kolga. Eduard Kolga was a volunteer with the anti-Soviet pro-German Estonians. These are Estonians, not Ukrainians, Estonians, who fought in what they've called the Forest Brothers movement. I may be mispronouncing this in Estonian. Metsavanand is their name, or was their name. And they fought with the Germans against Soviet forces during World War II and in the years following the defeat of the Wehrmacht and of Germany. Now, Eduard Kolga says he spent part of the war in a Russian prison camp from which he claims to have escaped in 1942 when he returned to Estonia. What he then did in collaboration with the Germans for the 2 years they had left before they were forced out of Estonia by the Russians, and what Eduard Kolga did in Estonia until 1951 remained undisclosed by his grandson, Marcus, who's made a documentary film about it. That's what I've watched. That's what you can all watch. Now, Eduard Kolga arrived with his father and two sons in Halifax, Canada, in 1951. Grandson Marcus was born in Toronto in 1973. But in his own, Marcus Kolga's, wiki profile, he doesn't even identify Canada as his own country. Nope. He says in his own wiki profile, Marcus Kolga says Canada's just a geographic location for him to conduct Estonian money-making business. He describes himself as, quotes, an Estonian journalist and political scientist in Canada. Well, that's the way he sees it. So both Kolga grandfather and Kolga grandson have played active roles in the Estonian diaspora in Canada, and you can follow their adventures in the Estonian diaspora's Twitter stream and publications. But what those come down to nowadays is that both Papa Kolga and grandson Kolga represent the same virulent Russia hatred as Chomiak and Freeland have done in the Ukrainian diaspora. And now that's Canadian policy, state policy. Chomiak and Freeland and the two Kolgas have long advocated war against Russia as Canadian policy for the benefit of their countrymen in their countries, Ukraine and Estonia, and for the advancement of themselves in Canada. Freeland's doing a bit better than Kolga, as everybody understands. So both of them, Freeland and Kolga, are named on the Russian Foreign Ministry list of Canadians banned from entering Russia.
She's doing quite a bit better than a lot of people. The subtitle of this report, again, out of the University of Regina and Maryland College, Enemy of My Enemy, Russian Weaponization of Canada's Far Right and Far Left to Undermine Support to Ukraine. And as in the report, they cite people that say the stuff that you just said, that you are using Russian disinformation by talking about Minister Freeland's provenance, her heritage, yes, in a way that will undermine her and undermine support for the Ukraine, regardless of whether it's factual or not.
Following our broadcast, I'll post a piece, and the audience want to read all the background stuff, all the evidence, and there's lots of evidence. There are two films on Grandpapa Colga, so they can look it up and read it for themselves. Dimitri Lascaris has also done a very good piece analyzing the untruthfulness of this report. And I want to mention that if you don't want to believe me, and go right ahead, folks.
Yeah, well, Dimitri's been on the show many times, and at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, his piece is More Pro-NATO Propaganda Masquerading as Academic Analysis. I have no doubt that what you're saying is true, but that doesn't matter. What I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's regarded as in the service of the enemy. Whether it's factual or not doesn't matter. If it's deemed to be supporting so-called Kremlin talking points, then it fits into this report, enemy of my enemy. It fits into their parameter of making you a troll in the service, or anyone else a troll in the service.
Colga's tried that before. Let's do a little bit of arithmetic here, and you can see how basically silly this is. There's 23 pages in this report. It says that the researchers spent 6 months investigating 200,000 Twitter accounts. Okay, 200,000 they investigated. They came up with there's two numbers in there. They don't explain the contradiction. They come up with 48 and then 90, quotes, most influential accounts. They call that the core of the supportive ecosystem. Well, that makes a green notion, ecosystem. That's baloney words. The supportive ecosystem amplifying pro-Russian narratives in Canada. Amplifying pro-Russian narratives in Canada. Now, the calculation, they say, of this ecosystem used, quotes, various methods such as mapping all accounts that retweeted the most influential accounts at different points of time. But what's influential, and you hit the nail on the head there, Chris, what's influential isn't judged by any normal metric when you do this sort of counting. It was judged by a bunch of so-called experts called our analysts, who were familiar with these accounts and were tracking them for years. That's Colga referring to himself. So Russian influence narrative, Russian-aligned posts, active pro-Putin narratives were selected out of the Twitter stream of this huge number, 200,000, come down to 90, which turn out to have tiny, tiny, arithmetically, followers, less than 1,400, according to the report, for more than 80% of these so-called influentials. Well, how are you influential if you've got less than 1,400 followers? Well, they fool you with a graphic that purports to show, with a lot of dots and colors and lines, how the Russian-aligned ecosystem works. That's their phrase for it, folks. It's a cartoon. This is a caricature. It's baloney. It's fake arithmetic. Everything's fake about this. What it is instead is Colga and his friends at the University of Regina and these other academic places, both Canadian and American, are selling themselves. They're mercenaries, they're information warriors, and we can track back the money in each of these individual cases, and not just Colga.
Dimitri, in his article about this, he says that these guys, they don't supply the metrics of their metrics. They don't say how they determined who was far right and who was far left, and they didn't determine which sites, they didn't name them. But when you're talking, John, about arithmetic, if he's in 6 months, if they went through 200,000 odd Twitter accounts, that means they're sifting through an average of 1,100 accounts a day. That seems like quite a lot to me. How big is, do you know, like who, how many researchers we're talking about here? If it's just Marcus, or does he have like his auntie on the payroll or something as well, or what? I mean, that's a lot of work.
It's not a lot of work if you've got a machine set up to do it. There are five co-founders of the research group that calls itself KDAC. That's wait for it, Center for Artificial Intelligence, Data, and Conflict. That turns into CAIDAK, KDAC. Okay? That's the group, plus an entity you mentioned called Digital Public Square. KDAC has five co-founders, Laura Kushain, Denelson Barbosa, Brian McQueen, Cody Buntain, and Matthew Taylor. Now, I followed each of those people to their back pocket where their wallet is to find out where the money comes from and what they've done to distinguish themselves and how they could possibly have processed 200,000 Twitter accounts. The technology for doing this comes from one person who's identified as a supporter of this research. His name's Max Schmeiser or Schmeiser. He's a Canadian from Regina. He's currently employed as a data management at Netflix. He was a data management expert at Twitter, so he knows how to do this with a machine. There's another chap called Cody Buntain. He's an American in Maryland, and he sells online information ecosystem analysis through a consulting company called Bunta.in LLC. And he's been employed selling this stuff by the U.S. arms manufacturer Raytheon and a Pentagon-funded research consultancy called Giant Oak. And then there's a professor of IT and mathematics and machines. His name's Denelson Barbosa. Now, he works with a California startup that sells this kind of machine processing stuff, and it's called DiffBot, D-I-F-F-B-O-T, and it markets its knowledge, quotes, as a service. I'm quoting from their website. So this is, you ask the question, how could they do this? They did it by machine, but a machine is only going to find what it's directed to find, and there's one other chap in this list of co-founders who has got a mysterious background like Colger's, a mystery that's worth analyzing. His name is Brian McQueen. Now, Brian McQueen has the following background. Dr. McQueen says he was in Libya collecting field intelligence during the NATO military operation to overthrow and ultimately kill Muammar Gaddafi. McQueen says he was doing a PhD, and I'm quoting from his own website or his own bio, in Misrata, Libya, from July 2011 to March 2012, where he says he was investigating the genesis and evolution of 236 fighting groups that emerged during the uprising in Misrata. Now, wait a minute. Mr. McQueen was studying for a PhD among groups shooting at the government of Libya, and he gets into a combat zone, which happened to have been the combat zone assigned to the British military and the British MI6, and they even gave their operation in that time frame, in that location, a name. It was called Operation Ellamy. Somehow or other, Mr. McKinn begins his academic career making a PhD on one side of a civil war in which the British are shooting at targets in the region he's in. Well, I never heard of a PhD done in those conditions unless it's working with, embedded in the military operation itself. Now, that's the sort of person who's a co-founder of a war against Russia that's called Enemy of My Enemy, that seems to be sponsored by KDAC and may, in a certain sense, be sponsored by McDonnell Laurier, but is certainly endorsed by the Globe and Mail. Now, wait a minute. That's where the tracks lead. Every listener listening to us today, and all the others who might check in a bit later, have to ask themselves, are they being deliberately insulted by a bunch of mercenaries to say that any message sent at us, at our brains or through our ears, any message influences us whether we agree with it or not. There is a distinction drawn in the report between so-called active and passive audiences. Well, passive audience turns out to mean school children, dummies, people who are assumed not to think, people who can't understand the English language when it's fired at them in 280 characters of a tweet. The assumption is insulting to an adult. So, not to insult Canadian adults here, Mr. Colger, Dr. McQuinn, and the rest of the gang want the Canadian government in Ottawa to pay them to prepare curricula and censorship systems so as to protect Canadian children from being passively indoctrinated by any statement about anybody's grandfather with which somebody might disagree. In other words, this is a mercenary effort to establish a new form of censorship in Canada in which people are considered so stupid, so passive, so dumb, or so childlike, innocent, naive, they have to be protected not from the meaning of the message so they can think for themselves, but from the message itself. Well, that covers everything, doesn't it?
Well, three of the messages they're most worried about that Canadians might erroneously take up as regards Ukraine is one, that the Ukraine war could lead to a nuclear confrontation between nuclear superpowers, this being pretty widely recognized as a proxy war, that there's a vast and rampant corruption in Ukraine, both before and now, and that it was NATO's expansion playing a role in creating the conditions for war that we see right now. These are three, I think, fairly well-established facts on their face. But as I said before, it's irregardless of truth when it comes to the way these guys, their algorithms aren't worried about the truth of the matter. They're just worried about people's conclusions about the information that they're seeing. And therein lies the problem, is the way I'm reading it.
And you read it right. I hope I haven't insulted anybody's children, or if there are any children listening. I've got six grandchildren, six of them, starting at 3, 5, 6, 7, 18, and 21. I care a lot about, I care so much for their naivety and innocence. I've all urged them never to become a journalist like me and never believe what their grandfather tells them. I'm very concerned about the innocence and the capacity to think of my children in the United States. So I tell them, you've got to think for yourself and don't believe a word your grandfather says. My advice to them is not to accept a universal censorship system run by a committee on which people like Grandpa and Freeland and Grandpa Colger's descendants will be committee members paid nice high salaries, inflation indexed.
Well, John, we're fast running out of time, John, for this segment, but you and I will continue on in a minute or so. Can you wrap up
in 60 seconds, folks? Put this one in the trash can, but don't forget that the folks, you can put the article in the trash can, but these people are teaching your children in universities right down the street from you. First. Second, your taxpayer dollar is being used in Canada and in the United States to fund this stuff. $150 million worth of State Department money goes to funding this sort of stuff for your trash can. That's a threat to your pocket, and ultimately the censorship they want to introduce is a threat to your brain.
Enemy of my enemy, Russian weaponization of Canada's far right and far left to undermine support to Iran, or to Ukraine, rather. Iran's next, I think, on the list. Thanks, John, for coming on. And we're going to continue in this vein in an extended format. But for now, we'll say goodbye. And thanks to Ken Stone of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War for coming on. Go check them out at HamiltonCoalitionHCWS.ca. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Chris.